Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. As our guests write in their wonderful new book, Good Prose, The Art of Nonfiction, Stories and Advice from a Lifetime of Writing and Editing. For the past three decades, American culture has become louder, faster, more disjointed. For immediacy of effect, writers can't compete with popular music or action movies, cable network news, or the multiplying forms of instant messaging. Writers shouldn't try. There is no need to try. Writing remains the best route we know toward clarity of thought and feeling. This book, The Authors Write, is mainly a practical one. It's product of years of experiments in three types of prose: writing about the world, writing about ideas, and writing about the self. Our guests are Tracy Kidder. You know Tracy Kidder. He is the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of a number of books, Strength in What Remains, Mountains Beyond Mountains, My Detachment, Hometown, Old Friends Among Schoolchildren, House, and the Soul of a New Machine. Richard Todd has been Tracy's editor for a long, long time. He has written cultural criticism for a number of magazines, including The Atlantic Monthly, The New York Times, and Harper's. He has had a long career as a magazine and book editor, serving as executive editor of The Atlantic, editor of The New England Monthly, and publishing books under his own imprint at Houghton Mifflin. He's a graduate of Amherst. He has taught there, and he is currently on the faculty of the Goucher College MFA program. We'll be welcoming phone calls. I think we'll have quite a few. Not only is this a book about writing, it also highlights, which I found interesting, great writing. So there are recommendations of nonfiction that you really ought to read. There are recommendations on usage and books that you should have for usage. And what are some of their, this is always fun, pet peeves when it comes to words, and that maybe we shouldn't be using the way that we use these days. A hint, one of them is terrorism. Here's our phone number for you to join the conversation, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Tracy Kidder, hello. Thanks so much for being with us.
It's a pleasure, Kathleen.
Yeah, great to have you here. And Richard Todd, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
All right, let's talk about the meeting. It was many years ago, and it's lasted some 40 years. When was the initial meeting, Richard?
Well, it was back in the early 70s. I think we had a hard time putting an actual date on it, but Tracy walked in, presented himself, and we just sort of went from there.
And Tracy,
I'm sorry, Kathleen. Well, I think actually what happened was that I had worked remotely. I hadn't really met him. I met him by phone, and I was working on this article, I think, which I rewrote maybe 30 or 40 times.
Oh.
But, you know, finally. And then I think I went to Boston and met him to celebrate the fact that it was actually going to be published, an undistinguished little article.
When I read about your writing and when I've read your books, too, I think about the enormous amount of work that you put into them. You were such an earnest young man, and I would imagine that you're an earnest person now, too, aren't you, Tracy?
Well, I don't know. I don't know if earnest.
Hardworking. Really hardworking.
Well, I'm not as hardworking. Excuse me?
I think he has his earnest moments.
No, I'm not as hardworking as I used to be, but I used to work really hard. I figured that I had to make up for lack of talent with hard work, you know. And it's hard work is being willing to do hard work is a species of talent, anyhow.
I think you're right. I think it's important. What one thing that struck me, because we're in the medium of just talking, and there it goes, and it's out there, and it's over, and you're on to something else. Writing is so completely different, and both of you talk about, although from different perspectives, because one of you is the editor in this relationship, how often you have to take the word and rewrite it and rewrite it and work it over and over and over. That's, to be very good at what you do, you have to do that, Richard?
Well, I suppose there are people, some people who claim, anyway, that they just sit down and do it. But that hasn't been my experience. Most writers need to rewrite, and good things happen when you rewrite.
But, you know, the rewriting, there are several kinds of rewriting. Two main kinds, I think. One is tinkering, which is important. But the other is throwing it away and starting over. which is the more important and, of course, the more difficult, I think. And it's the one that's hardest. I mean, the small amount of teaching I've done, that's the hardest thing to persuade students to do.
When have you had to do that, Tracy?
With every single book that I've written.
Every book? Really?
Sure. Kathleen, I write really fast to prevent remorse for having written badly. And Dick tells me all along, you know, as I give him chunks of the rough draft, he says, it's fine, keep going. And then we get to the end, and I pretty much, often, almost the entire thing gets thrown away. But I haven't lost anything. I've figured out what doesn't work. I've begun to get my notes into my mind, really securely fastened there. And I keep rewriting, and usually we write 10 drafts. But, toward the end, it gets, the changes are fewer. We once compared it to golf, you know, successive approximations. You get closer to the hole no matter how bad you are at it.
And how do you know, Richard, because you have an unusual situation here, how do you know when something that Tracy has written needs to be revised, when it needs work, or when anybody needs work? How do you, Richard Todd, know that?
Well, you do have to be careful. It's true. I try not to wish my own design on something. But Tracy and I have worked together a long time, and it doesn't take, I think if an editor expresses even a little unease, it's often the case that a writer is uneasy too. So sometimes you just have to say, something isn't working here, and the writer says, I know it, and then you sort of recognize it and figure out how to fix it.
Sometimes the diagnosis is the hardest part, and that's why I think that most writers need another set of eyes. Maybe they don't see that something is wrong, but it's even harder. Sometimes it's very hard to see that something is wrong because they're your own words, but I think it's even harder once you realize that something's wrong to figure out why. It may not be obvious. No, it isn't just that you wrote an ungrammatical sentence. That's not ever the issue, really.
Mm-hmm. And Tracy, you're in a perhaps unusual situation for a writer in that you spend a long period of time learning about whatever it is, a house or learning about a doctor in Haiti who's doing phenomenal work or learning about various countries. It's a long process of research for you before you even begin to write, isn't it? Your books take a long time.
Yeah, between 3 and 4 years. But it's a great privilege, too. I mean, I've been very lucky to be able to write for a living. I think anyone who can write, manages to write for a living, has to be pretty lucky. And I get to enter these fascinating lives, these worlds. I spend, a year and a half, a year, 2 years, depends. Usually I start with a character, with a person or a group of people, and then I get interested in the subjects that preoccupy them. But I wouldn't have traded it for anything.
And do you do a similar kind of research in the articles that you've written and in the book that you wrote as well, Richard?
I have never done the sort of intensive, extended research that Tracy has done. I don't know that I have the fortitude and the patience for it, really. It's a special talent to be able to really do what they now call immersion journalism.
Right.
Is that what they call it? I didn't know that.
Yes, well, that's what you're doing, Tracy. It's called immersion journalism.
I'm glad to know that.
Next time.
Now you know what you've been doing. It's good to know that at some point in your life.
Yeah.
How important is the first sentence? And you include some wonderful first sentences. Please feel free to read them as we talk here. How important is that sentence? Do you lose a reader if it's not great?
Well, I think it's important, but it's also important not to get hung up on it. It's important to get in there somehow. One of the great things about writing is revision, and you can a lot of first sentences to books have been written well into the process.
Yeah, I think Hemingway said, and one shouldn't always listen to everything he said about writing, but I think he did say that it's almost never the case that the first sentence that you had the first sentence right away. I do have writer friends, and I did it myself. I remember a night when I spending a whole night trying to write the first sentence of an article for the Atlantic Monthly, a whole night and about a ream of paper. And, you know, after you've done that enough, you either quit writing or, you know, go to see a psychiatrist, or you start to find another way. So I just try. That's one of the reasons I just plow on, because it is almost never the case that you know where a story begins until you've figured out where it ends, or often the case anyway. And sometimes, you know, I remember cases where I had a perfectly good beginning that I threw away, and then some months and drafts later, Todd said, "What about that old beginning?" you know, so but that should not be the reader's experience. I mean, what you really want is for the reader to think this looks easy.
Right.
That seems natural.
And you write that a good beginning achieves clarity, but it doesn't always mean brevity, and it doesn't always mean simplicity. Do you want to give us examples, Richard?
Well, I think we quote in the book that wonderful opening of Nabokov's, which manages to go back and forth in time, but it's a fairly complicated idea, one thing follows after another. That sounds so simple, but it's not always so easy to do just to make one thing follow after another, and that is a great comfort to the reader. One of the things we talk about is one of the errors that we worry over is people trying to say it all at once or mm-hmm. trying to say something spectacular at the start.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Well, isn't that a problem in putting a whole book together, Tracy? When you've done all this research, you must have reams and reams of notes. So how do you make a decision what you're going to never say at all or what you're going to put, you know, in Chapter 5 instead of right at the beginning when you want people to know it right away?
Well, that's part of my rationale for writing so many drafts and trying to write them quickly. Because if I didn't write them quickly, I wouldn't ever get a single book written. But I audition things. I try out material. I mean, often what you're looking for, if you have a superabundance of notes, which is what you want, you want to have a lot of stuff to choose among, or choose from. But what I do is I try things out, and if I find something that seems to work wonderfully well on the page, and they can stand for 10 other, you know, things I witnessed, well, you know, that's kind of what I'm looking for. But I only do it by trial and error, and once in a while I make a good guess, you know, it seems to me. But I can't tell you how many times I've been doing research and thought, this is definitely going to be in my book, and have found later that it's not going to be in my book at all.
I think one of the examples you use and talk about this process, Richard, it was about among school children, and there were a series of days when you were following this teacher and absolutely nothing happened, or it was something in that book that was I think it was that book, wasn't it? It was a huge chunk of writing that you just had to, that you thought might be really crucial to the story, and at some point you just had to drop it.
Yeah.
It that book?
Do you remember, Dick?
Well, equally, in that book there was this has a great deal to do with research. Tracy took pages and pages of notes, which he thought were not going to be consequential. But then they turned out to be consequential, because a little boy he'd been just casually observing turned out to have a crisis. And to have had those things down on the page was just a great blessing. Yep. When he came to tell the story. And there was a dramatic moment in the book that then that looked terribly dramatic at the time, but did end up getting cut because it distorted the story.
Oh, my goodness. How hard that must be, Tracy, to cut that.
No. Actually, that's the thing. Once you do it enough times, you don't mind it at all. I mean, after a while, when you're working on a book, you know, you get good at your book, but you also get pretty ruthless about it. You know, and I do think that that's one of the things that I've had to learn and have to learn again and again, is to fall out of love with your own words, the pages that you've written, and, you know, even including ones that you've labored over. And sometimes it feels like liberation to get rid of something, but particularly if it's that thing that's standing in the way of making the whole thing work. I don't find that difficult anymore. I really don't find it painful. I can remember a time when I did.
But yeah, and lots of people do. But,
of course,
it's true.
And sometimes,
sometimes you cut things that are perfectly good. It's just that they're not good, as Tracy says, for the whole.
That's also why you need an editor, because who's especially ruthless and mean. I used to really resent it when Todd, particularly with articles for The Atlantic, when things were being cut, and I thought he was trying to curb my my colorful characters or something that I thought was particularly good, and he'd have me cut it. And I once threatened to make a list of all of these wonderful things that he'd made me cut. But I only didn't get very far making up that list before I came to an item that would have been on it, and then I realized how embarrassing it would have been.
He was right. And what about this whole process? But this is what makes people writers, I guess. Is it ever okay when you have all this information to tell the story from your introduction to a person until when you leave that person? How do you decide? And if you've already got the whole, how do you decide when you're going to withhold certain things or move around the sequence of time so that the middle part might be closer to the beginning and the end might be in the middle? And how do you see the whole
First of all, if it's nonfiction, you're not making up, you're not making up dates, but you can certainly, move around in time. It's just that, you have to make it so that at least the discerning reader can see that you're doing that. Those sorts of decisions are really important. The problem is that you can't prescribe them. They always have to arise out of the material itself, the particular material itself. And they really come down to what we call structure, right? And I can't discover that usually right away. Sometimes it's more obvious than others. Sometimes you can have a very straightforward structure, but even then you still have to figure out what, as Todd likes to say, the whole art of this is making some things big and other things little.
Mm-hmm.
And just how much space you allot to something is an assertion about its importance, and vice versa. But this is part of what writing is about what fashioning a story is all about. And it's a lot of fun once it starts to work.
I would imagine.
We tend to be partisans of chronology, I think, on the side of chronology. Not that we aren't willing to dump it when it needs to be dumped, but I noticed that a number of writers tend to think the opposite way, that the last thing you want to do is tell a story straightforwardly. Sometimes that's the way it needs to be told.
We're going to welcome phone calls. We're talking with the authors of Good Prose, The Art of Nonfiction, Stories and Advice from a Lifetime of Writing and Reading. Tracy Kidder and Richard Todd, who have worked together since the early 1970s, are our guests this hour. Tracy, of course, a Pulitzer Prize winner. He has won also the National Book Award, Robert Kennedy Book Award, the author of Strength and What Remains, My Detachment, Mountains Beyond Mountains, Hometown, Old Friends, Among School Children, House, and the Soul of Machine. Richard Todd is also with us. He has been editing Tracy's work for a number of years, and he has been writing on a wide range of themes for Harper's, The Atlantic Monthly, The New York Times, The Columbia Journalism Review. He's the author of The Thing Itself. Here's our phone number. Join us, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We start our phone calls with Dick in Bark River, Michigan. Hi, Dick.
Hello?
Hello. Go right ahead.
Yes, I guess I'm going to have to go on a tangent. My point was it's not really relevant to the general way this program is going, but it's about four readers reading books that have been translated. It's extraordinarily important to research for the best translation, the most accurate, and it's tangential, but it is a point. I'll stop there.
No, that's an interesting point. I would imagine both of you have had your works translated. How does that process take place? Tracy?
Well, it usually takes place without my knowledge. I had the first book I like to admit to having written, The Soul of a New Machine, was translated into Japanese and a bunch of other languages. But I remember asking, you know, paying someone a little money at a Japanese student at UMass to read it over and tell me how it was. And he said, well, you know, they've made it more polite. He said. But I, you know, I couldn't read Japanese, and I still can't, so I didn't know. But I'm very grateful for great translations. I'm not sure that the only criterion is how accurate they are, though. Particularly when it comes to something like poetry, but this is a tangent. Sorry.
Right.
I have a very sad story about translation. Foreign rights to my book, The Thing Itself, were offered widely, and they were bought by a publishing house in Croatia, the only sale made. I was very excited. In fact, I was thinking of going to Croatia, but a year later, they decided to cancel it. So it appears only in English.
All right. Thanks very much, Dick, for your call. Scott in La Crosse. Hi, Scott.
Hi, Kathleen. Another great program. Thanks so much. I guess I'd like to thank both of you gentlemen, since you collaborate on things that I enjoy a lot. I've admired your work, Mr. Kidder, ever since I first read The Soul of a New Machine. But the book of yours that really, really I just loved was My Detachment. And I just wonder, in retrospect, did that come out the way you wanted it? And are you happy with it? Because I think you did a wonderful job.
I am actually pretty happy with it. It got very strongly mixed reviews, including my mother hated it, for instance. it was one of the hardest books that I've ever had to write. Not because it was because it took me 15 years or more to write it. I wrote it, I tried to write it 4 or 5 different times and kept putting it away because I couldn't find a way to write honestly about myself. But I'm glad you liked it. I think sort of secretly pleased with it.
Mm-hmm.
Not so secret, actually. I said that.
As I was reading it, I could really feel that this was somebody talking about some very, very personal feelings about a very, interesting time of your life, huh?
Right. Well, I had not liked there have been so many memoirs coming out, and I was sort of picking on memoirs. And then I wrote a couple little things about the memoir craze, and then I went and made an exception for myself and wrote this one about my year as a soldier in Vietnam. One of my main justifications was that I was not in combat, and this was the most common kind of experience from that war, but the one least reported. But the real truth is that there was just something I wanted to get off my chest. And the other reason that I wrote it, I guess, is that Todd was very amused by the early stuff that I had written and some of the stories I had told him, and he kept, not badgering me exactly, but he kept reminding me of it.
Thanks very much. Appreciate it a lot.
Thank you, Scott. Thanks very much for the call. You mentioned Richard Tim O'Brien in the book and the tension between memory and memoir. His writing, of course, informed by his time in Vietnam as well. What is that tension, and how is it on display in his work?
Well, it's very interesting. He published both a memoir and a work of fiction, and the border between them is a little hard to discern. In that, in the work of fiction, he uses his own name and the names of the people he served with. It's fascinating to read the two of them together. Fascinating, and I think we found slightly problematic.
Tracy, how so?
I actually didn't find it too problematic. I think Dick did more than I. I like both of them very much, and in different ways. But it does invite a very interesting question having to do with for us, for Dick and me, I think we've always felt that if you call something nonfiction, factual narrative, then it ought to be factually accurate. But memoir has got to play by somewhat different rules, I think. I mean, it's named for memory, most plastic of our faculties. And, you know, some level of invention is almost inevitable. I'm not talking about just the out-and-out frauds, you know, person who writes a memoir saying he was in jail for a year when he was in jail for a night, you know. But what's so fascinating about the two Tim O'Brien books, both of which I really loved, is that they don't seem so terribly different.
Oh. Oh, that's interesting.
Well, what do you think? I mean, Dick, I'm not saying that very well.
Oh, I like them both too, and they just raise the question of what the limits of invention are. As Tracy says, all memoir contains a kind of invention. It's just different from reporting. But my bias, anyway, is toward the least invention the possible, and the closest to memory, as Tracy says, a plastic thing in itself. To the book that Hughes is close to what you think happened, seems to me to be the most effective memoir.
Mm-hmm.
Right, but don't forget your own phrase about imaginative reconstruction. I mean, reconstructed memories. I mean, that is, after all, what one is doing. And even in the most scrupulously reported one, of course, you know, what you end up with, we were talking about that one of the real powers of memoir is to get closer to one's memories but it's like building a beautiful desk. The desk is forever different from the wood. I don't know. There's something sort of spooky about it. Memoir comes in for a lot of criticism these days as a form, and rightly so. But, you know, if you really step back and you think about it, you say, well, you know, there are an awful lot of bad memoirs, but there are a lot of bad novels, and there are a lot of bad narratives.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think we worry more about that form than others because it seems so self-indulgent. You know, I mean, it is true that there are other stories in the world than the story of your dysfunctional family.
Yes, there are. Thanks, Scott, very much for the call. Allison in Milwaukee, hello.
Hi. I read the book about Paul Farmer.
Yes.
And I was completely blown away by it. I stayed up all night to read it and was all ready to go volunteer and work for him. Mm. I mean, I was so moved by the description, and it was so complicated to describe how he'd gone down there, I think, as an anthropologist, and then had to go back to medical school just to do the work he wanted to do there, and how exhausting it was to read about how much time he spent, how hard he worked. And then at the very end of the book, and I don't even know if this is true, but you know how you have a memory of having read something. I remember you describing a scene where he walked particularly far to go see someone to help them. And there were flies. You described that there were flies all over everyone because of the conditions. And I was just thinking, oh, my God, I don't think I could do that. How would you do it? And it tripled my admiration for him, and then made me think, oh, Allison, you know, you live in America. Your life is so clean, and everything. Could you do this? Could you dedicate yourself like that? And so I was just amazed at how beautifully written that was, and how I was like crying. I couldn't wait to work for him. So it was really, really one of the most powerful experiences I've ever had reading something.
Oh my, Tracy!
It's called Mountains Beyond Mountains.
Yes,
but I do think that's the best thing I've ever written.
Do you really?
Or perhaps ever likely to write? Yeah. Well, it's the most, but somehow the biggest subject, you know, taken through a person. I don't know. I'm not ashamed of any of the books that I've published, but I think that one. I don't know. I think it's pretty artful. It had a lot of help from Dick, that book, and it presented some interesting problems.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk. I love that book too, Tracy. You write about the problems of writing about a real person. And let me read part of your book, your collaborative book, and get you to respond to this. To try to depict real people is to grant yourself an immense power over individual lives, and the power is easily abused. Consider the difference between facts and truth. You can string together a number of facts about someone and create a picture. It may be critical, it may be flattering. That picture may accord with your own best sense of who that person really is, but it may violate the subject's own sense of his or her identity. What rules govern this delicate process? Richard?
Well, yeah, that is the real nub of the problem, the moral sort of situation you're in when mm-hmm. when you write nonfiction. Because you never get the whole person. The person is has a life that goes, that happened before and goes presumably beyond the book. And so you do have to be, you have to come to your own best sense of who that person is and make sure that the things you report, because you can't report at all, accord with that best sense. But there's an element of judgment, and you have to be, you have to have a very clear eye on your own process.
Tracy,
I'm sorry, but just to go to the, I'm sorry, Kathleen.
Please talk. It's your turn.
No, and I just was going to add that so far as there are any rules, the one principal one is to try to do your very best to make sure that the person you're writing about has as clear a sense of what he or she might be getting into as you do. You know, you can't predict the way a person will feel about a portrait like that. You can't allow that person to control what you say about them. But you can, it seems to me, really talk through the, you know, those facts and the other possible things, you know, if you've had some experience. But you really want to give them fair warning. I don't believe in sneaking up on people. Now, that's partly because I've written about private individuals. If I were writing about vice presidents, you know, or presidents, I think the rules are somewhat different.
Mm-hmm. Well,
the legal rules are very different.
Well, what about the relationship? Because you also were able to, considering your personality and Dr. Paul Farmer's personality, he was welcoming to you. You felt a connection with him. He was friendly toward you. He was not somebody who was holding you at arm's length. That makes a difference, doesn't it?
Oh, sure. And now part of my job is to try to get, for the kind of books that I'm interested in writing, I have to get pretty close to the people I'm writing about. You know, but these agreements, these understandings have to be struck at the, you know, I think created at the beginning, and then, you know, and then you hope to have the person act as naturally as possible. Paul Farmer is a very charming man. He's a lovely guy to travel with, you know, and because he's funny and he's considerate, and when he gets sick, he takes care of you.
Right.
But he, you know, I think you also want to make sure at the beginning that the person knows that you're something less and more than a friend. I don't know, this can be a sort of nerve-wracking issue. I don't know that one is really ever could really be friends with someone while you're doing that research or writing about someone. After the fact, yeah, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
In that book, you know, I did write about myself. I didn't do it to be self-revelatory. I did it because of the problem that a character like Paul Farmer, or maybe just Paul Farmer himself, presents, which is that he's an improbable character, and that he is so self-sacrificing, so passionate about his cause, so talented, that he's apt to make readers kind of resent him. And I wanted to have a sort of everyman, this character, me, I mean, I hope an accurate depiction, to react to him, a person much less virtuous than him, to stand in for the reader.
Mm-hmm.
To say, you know, I know this guy's making you uncomfortable right now. He's making me uncomfortable, too, and here's what I think about my discomfort. And
yes.
So that you could, in the end, see him clearly for the sort of remarkable gift to the world that he is.
Yeah. Thank you, Allison, so much for your call. Wonderful call. Joan in Eau Claire, hi.
Good morning. In fiction, we address the protagonist's fatal flaw at a particular point in the novel. Now, in nonfiction, is the subject's fatal flaw even addressed? And is this merely a chronological recording of the events? Or is this even an issue, depending upon the subject?
Richard?
Well, I think that it is, as I said before, you know, you do try to come to some sort of a assessment of a person. Haven't thought of it ever in terms of fatal flaws. I don't tend to think of people that way, and I don't think Tracy does. But you do look for something that goes beyond the mere facts or the mere quotations. You try to give a sense of the wholeness of a person.
It's interesting that I haven't thought of it this way. It's a very interesting question. I'm not sure that all the fiction I admire conforms quite to that pattern, although a lot of it does, clearly. One of the things that I've always been interested in writing about is virtue. And in the case of writing about a virtuous person, take a book like Schindler's List, which is quite a wonderful book, better than the movie, I think. There's a man who has a lot of flaws that actually make his acts of courage and altruism all the more plausible. So it's a sort of opposite things. And I think that is based on a real character's life. In fact, I know it is. But I'm not anywhere near answering your question. I don't know. Everything with nonfiction, you're kind of stuck with you are stuck with the facts, and you're stuck with the person that you're writing about. And the person may not have a fatal flaw. In the period of of that person's life that you're writing about, the fatal flaw may not prove fatal. But I'm sorry, that's kind of a wimpy answer. I don't really have a better one.
You'll think about it. She'll think about it. Everybody will think about it. You can't answer things right away sometimes. Thank you, Joan, very much for your call. Could we spend a few, because some of these are funny and interesting, could we spend a few moments on usage? You recommend that writers have modern English usage right in front of them. Can you talk a little bit about that? And can you talk about debates that have taken place, and I wonder if they are pertinent now to nonfiction writers, of what words you can use, what words you should not use, what's overused, who's told writers over the years what they should use and what they shouldn't use. What about our sixth grade English teacher? I remember mine very well, Mrs. Henneberg, and there are certain words that I will not use because she told me not to.
Well, we quote the great Emerson, you know, who said that you should never use the word development.
Right. I know. I read that. What? I thought.
That's a little cautionary story for everyone who decides to prescribe on language. Language changes, and we're aware of that. That doesn't stop us from having all kinds of little annoyances, and we do strike out at them. My favorite word, I think the only word we list, that's not true. One of the only words we list avoiding is the word eponymous, which always seems to me to be, and I'm looking for a word that expresses this idea, it seems to be a word that people use to signify that they know the word eponymous.
My favorite of our prohibitions, these aren't prohibitions. We're not trying to prescribe for everybody, but we are talking about words and often usages that we wish could be expunged from the language. And the last of our not very long list, but pretty long list, is all sports metaphors, which
right.
I think is a good one.
Right. I keep waiting. They're all so similar. Every now and then you get a sports reporter who's very, very good, and you say everybody should be like this because there are so many more words that you could use. What is this word? You mentioned this. I didn't know what this word meant. I'd never heard it before in one part of the book. Endorsive? Is that the word? Endorsive?
Yes, endorsive.
Oh, yes.
Yes. Tell us about that one.
Well, it isn't a word, but it's a word that was made up by a former editor of The Atlantic, Bill Whitworth, to express something he did not approve of in Tracy's work.
So, one little piece of my work, yeah.
Yes,
and
right.
It was absolutely appropriate, but I was very irritated at the time, and so I said a few choice things about that word. but in later life, Todd and I found ourselves using it because it actually expresses something very nicely, which is that, you know, the matter of tone is really important in any story or any piece of writing, really. And if the writer appears to be to think that someone who has just said something stupid or really particularly vulgar, if the writer seems to think that this was a nifty phrase, well, that's not good for the writer. That's really terrible for the writer. You know, for the reader to feel that he has figured out something that the writer hasn't figured out is really, that's the fatal flaw of tone, and it's a really bad one.
And concerning usage, the modern English usage, we should all have copies of that?
The Great Fowler, which is no longer very modern. It was published in, I guess, around the turn of the last century. But it is sort of the ultimate guide to niceties in language. And we particularly recommend the section on the difference between which and that, and please don't ask me to explain it now.
Very good on something called elegant variation.
Or yes,
the
sentry
clause. I think it's really quite useful still.
It's a wonderful book, and it's useful, and it's also, if you are interested in language, it's extremely entertaining.
I'm sure
it's
very
funny, yeah, because he's such a curmudgeon.
We'll welcome more phone calls in a moment. We're speaking with the authors, and their authors themselves, and editors of Good Prose, The Art of Nonfiction, Stories and Advice from a Lifetime of Writing and Editing. Tracy Kidder and Richard Todd, their relationship goes back for almost 40 years, which is a long, long time, when Tracy was wanting to write an article for The Atlantic. He came looking for an assignment. The story goes Richard was the editor, and as a result, they formed a lifelong association. First book the two worked on was The Soul of a New Machine, which won the Pulitzer Prize. All right, two more phone calls. Did I give you the number? I do this so much, I forget. 800-486-8655 is our number. 800-486-8655. Email, you can use that, and that is talk@wpr.org. Or you can always leave a message for us on our Facebook page, which is The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We return to your phone calls to Bill in Watertown next. Hi, Bill.
Yes, hi. Thank you for taking my call. Hope everyone is well. Listening to these guys has just brought back so many thoughts. I just finished a book of my own. It was the first one. And I wanted to go into it not studying how to write a book. Just took the advice of two authors, Stephen King, which was tell the truth, write to the truth, and cut your darlings. And then from Ben Logan, who suggested that people write to detail. But specifically, I want to mention that in hearing your guests talk about how to write about personalities, is very interesting, and it's something I struggled with, trying to tell the truth, as Stephen King said, but without being judgmental and by being gracious. But still, you had to make it interesting. And the other thing that I found was really difficult was going through the process the first time. It was like trying to untangle a messed up ball of yarn because I just kept writing, as one of your guests said, before I realized what I needed to do in order to make it into a book.
What did you write about, Bill?
I wrote about the title of the book is Purpose Beyond 2012, The Wisconsin Idea, Occupy Wall Street, and Democracy's Future. And it's a historical fiction of characters dealing with purpose in a dysfunctional economy and democracy, and then offering solutions as to how to correct the problems. Mm-hmm. And it's both pop culture, and so I try to write the story as though, you know, so it's interesting to people and not just political.
Right. Oh, it's quite an ambitious book, isn't it? Gentlemen?
I'm sorry, I'm Dick. You have-
yeah, that is an ambitious book and
right.
and an extremely interesting subject. And I would guess your problem or your challenge is to is bringing characters forward in a way that allows you to find someone to carry the weight of some very, very big ideas. I'd be very interested to see how this comes out.
Yes, we would too. Like, keep us informed, Bill. Put it in our hands if you can in some way. Thank you. Connie in Madison. Hi, Connie.
Hi. I'm very interested in the intimacy of the relationship between the editor and the writer. It strikes me that there's almost an unbelievable degree of vulnerability that exists in this relationship, a little bit like the way a master teacher and a music student exist, because you do the thing that you do right in front of the teacher in real time. And you trust the trust that you have to have in the teacher, that the teacher or the editor in this case wishes you well and wishes you only good, has to carry through these moments of discipline or conflict or cutting. And also the editor has to have the capacity to see believe to the end of the project, when perhaps the writer may get discouraged or be frustrated. And it strikes me that there must be some ways in which there's an emotional bond between the two of you that is durable, trustworthy, to carry through moments when there's got to be some conflict. Could you talk about the emotional and the vulnerability and the other emotional dimensions of this remarkably intimate relationship?
Mm, thank you, Connie, so much for that call.
You know, I have some thoughts about that. I think that's very, you're absolutely right. Years ago, Bill Whitworth, who was the estimable editor of the Atlantic Monthly for a while, said to me, you know, every writer needs another set of eyes. And I think that's true. It's certainly true for me. But how you choose that, you know, one has to be careful. To be a good editor, I think you need at least that modicum of selflessness that allows a person to take a constructive interest in someone else's creations or performances, in the case that you mentioned. And you know, the worst kind of other set of eyes is someone who doesn't wish you well, and even worse, doesn't know it. But you know, over the years, we've come to I trust Todd almost completely, and you know, there are times his judgment, and I also know that, you know, our interests, though I'm sure they're not identical, but they're about as close as they can be. You know, we both want to write a good, to come out with a good book, you know, and it's been a lot of fun. We don't yell at each other. I think I yelled at him for the first time in my life writing this book near the end of the process. But my excuse is that I was ill, and I'm not used to the role of editor myself.
We switched roles, which was very confusing. It's very, very, you know, we were editing one another. It was a fresh experience.
We do have, I mean, you know, talking about intimacy, I mean, you know, I think, you know, this is, it's a funny word. It can cover too much ground for comfort, but we do have our own private language. I mean, I tried to, in one of the little essays near the end of this book, I tried to talk about some of the terms that we've invented and some of the strange rituals. But that's sort of the way people are after a while. Mm.
The caller raises a very good point, I think, about the dangers of editing. And as in teaching, it's very easy. Writing is vulnerable, and almost anything can be mocked at a certain point in its creation. And one thing an editor has to learn to do is just sort of step back for a while and let something get going.
You have to see what might be there rather than what is there.
Right.
Yeah.
Todd's pretty good at that.
Thank you, Connie, so much for the call. Well, this was fun. I'm sorry it's coming to an end. Thank you so much for being with us this hour. And one thing that the book has done for me is that it's made me want to go in the direction of reading great writing, too. I love the fact that you have so many recommendations of of what we got to read in these
various... And it's hardly
various...
exhaustive. I mean,
right.
Guessing, there are all kinds of great stuff we left
yes.
out, but we did hope that this book would be of help to readers, too.
Yes, it is. It is. Thank you very much.
Enjoyed thank you.
The, yeah, thank you. Our thanks to Richard Todd and Tracy Kidder, and their book is Good Prose, The Art of Nonfiction, Stories and Advice from a Lifetime of Writing and Editing. Tracy, of course, Pulitzer Prize-winning author of a number of books. We've interviewed him about several of those. Richard Todd, who has been his editor since the first of those books was written. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, and thanks to Katie Madsen for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. Thanks for all of your calls and for listening.